In this issue, you'll discover how a little creative thinking can lead to big rewards. And then you'll hear why it's important to embrace new ideas, to experience failure, and reshape attitudes.
Failure is a gold mine. Successful people have at one time or another experienced catastrophic failure. They're people who have rolled up their sleeves and gone to work on a project in which they earnestly believed, only to discover themselves ridiculous and embarrassing failures in spite of all their plans and work. As a result, these people had to sit down and perform ruthless surgery upon their souls to examine themselves and the cause of their failure. The person who settles in for a lifetime of doing an average job in an average way experiences neither success nor failure, but rather a lifetime of middle-level performance. The single element permanently inhibiting his success is not a lack of inspiration or talent necessarily, but the absence of catastrophic failure and the soul surgery that follows it. The element lacking is shock therapy. Failure, the bucket of ice-cold water that forces him to take inventory, reorganize, re-educate himself, and realize that a large success in any field takes large effort and unflagging persistence and dedication. Don't let a big failure or a series of little ones keep you from trying again. William Blake wrote, "If the sun and the moon should doubt, they'd immediately go out." Perfectionism is a dangerous state of mind in an imperfect world. We set a goal of perfection before ourselves and groaningly conclude that it cannot be achieved. The best way is to forget doubts and set about the task at hand. While the battle is being fought or the cake is baking in the oven, leave the outcome to the future where it belongs. Failure is the best guarantee of future success. To fail, we have to try to do something. This in itself is an achievement, regardless of the outcome. So try again, and build your success upon the failures of the past. Go after that dream in your heart, give it everything you've got, and don't concern yourself about the outcome. Leave that to the future where it belongs. Concentrate only on your goal and on doing your best. Worthy triumphs cannot be won without faith enough to maintain our integrity.
A man's life is what his thoughts make of it. Everything comes if a man will only wait. I have brought myself by long meditation to the conviction that a human being with a settled purpose must accomplish it, and that nothing can resist a will that will stake even existence for its fulfillment. If you only care enough for a result, you will almost certainly attain it. Only you must then really wish these things, and wish them exclusively, and not wish at the same time 100 other incompatible things just as strongly. Our doubts are traitors, and make us lose the good we oft might win by fearing to attempt.
More than anything else, a person's manners tell the world who and what he is. To be well-mannered is to do the thing you should do, although you're not obliged to do it. In our day-to-day lives, manners are of more importance than laws. That is, the law touches us only here and there and now and then, but manners vex or please us, debase or exalt us, constantly. We do not know a man until we know how he spends his leisure. It is when a man ceases to do the things he has to do and does the things he likes to do that the character is revealed. It is then we see the inner man, his real self. The thing that's always bothered me is how a human being can live for 30 or 40 or 50 years and find no interest, no charm and excitement in the world. If someone should steal $10 from us, it might take us days to get over it. Yet how much priceless time do we steal from ourselves? Someone once calculated that the average person is given about a 500,000 hours, give or take 100,000 or so. And it's up to each of us to determine what his time on Earth is worth in whatever values he feels are important to him. But if we don't get what we want out of this life, it's seldom because we're not given enough time for it. We have more than enough time. As with most everything else, it's what we choose to do with it that makes all the difference. Each of us has a tendency to underestimate his own abilities. We should realize that we have, deep within ourselves, a reservoir of genius that can be tapped if we'll just dig deeply enough. In order to spot and seize an opportunity, or even to recognize an opportunity, we have to know where we're going, what it is we want to do and accomplish. It's always been the tendency of the human being to mistake the obvious for the truth, to see only the surface and miss entirely that which lies below. It seems that with us, in our age, we're concerned more with what a person or a thing looks like than with what is underneath. Ours seems to be an age of youth and beauty, of bright teeth, clear eyes, abundant health, so that we can run, not walk, to those events calculated to distract us. And this superficial attitude is as absurd as that of the ancients, which held that the sun traveled around the earth because that's what it appeared to do. That which is good or even great is always hidden from our view. Whatever causes anything in creation to be what it is that which we cannot see by looking at it. There is just as much for him or her as there is for anyone else. It's a matter of building upon our strengths instead of decrying and wailing and gnashing our teeth over our weaknesses. When we start thinking in new directions, which is the definition of genius, we tend to challenge everything we presently take for granted and throw out the window for a while all of our comfortable knowledge of how things are or how they should be. Well, this is the sort of information that we need to remind our children of, and ourselves, but particularly our children, so that if they don't happen to look like the picture on the package of baby food or the ads in the magazines and on television, they won't be scarred by unthinking children or adults whose frame of reference is the common, the superficial.
There are all kinds of people in this world. Those who are content to lead go-nowhere lives, and those who make the most of every opportunity they find. These are the people who transform even their handicaps into assets and add meaning to their lives. In short, they program themselves for achievement. You too can design your life by the goals you set for yourself.
There's nothing commonplace in the world except the mental attitude of man. Our attitudes are the result of choice. Each of us chooses his or her attitude. A human being can grow accustomed to and take for granted the most wonderful and astonishing things. Not just the miraculous world about him, but his work as well, and the people with whom he works, and the people with whom he lives. After a while, the glow, the radiance, seems to fade even from the most wonderful and delightful aspects of life. And that's too bad. It should never happen. Marcus Aurelius, a brilliant, thoughtful emperor of Rome about 2,000 years ago, said, "Every man is worth just so much as the things are worth about which he busies himself." Every man is worth just so much as the things are worth about which he busies himself. And that's about it. And once in a while, it's good to take a look at what we're doing and what we're noticing, what catches and holds our interest. Are we conscious of the miracle that consists of our living here on this small blue planet? Do we find awe and inspiration from the mystery that surrounds us during our personal holiday on Earth? If we think about it, the sameness of our lives will vanish, the ordinary will be a thing of the past, and we'll begin to notice and enjoy life again and all that it entails. We won't take people for granted anymore, or our work, or our lives. Before we turn loose of anything to which we've set our hand and mind, we should ask ourselves, is this up to my standards of quality? And because quality of any sort is a journey more than a destination, we should also ask ourselves, how can I improve on the quality of what I do? Wood burns because it has the proper stuff in it. And a man becomes great because he has the proper stuff in him. I think that the most fortunate adults are those who are living well today but who knew a deprived childhood. It's also true, I think, that the most creative people are those who had a rough time as kids. Children raised in poverty, or if not poverty, at least on the wrong side of the tracks, must fall back on their imagination for enjoyment. Their lives are filled with daydreams. Their imaginations become wonderfully active. In an instant, their bleak surroundings can vanish, and in the warm, sunny world of their minds, all sorts of wonderful things can happen to them. Under almost all conditions, there's a world to be enjoyed. But the most fortunate people seem to be those who knew a certain amount of privation. Success beyond anything we might now imagine lies in wait for those who can put together enough courage to actually live the life they imagine. You know, most people live in two worlds. There's the real world, the world in which they work and move and live, and there's the world of the imagination, the world they would secretly like to live in. What keeps them from moving from the world of reality into the world of their imagination is habit, and the fear of falling flat on their face in the attempt, and losing even the little which they presently have, and perhaps looking ridiculous in the eyes of their loved ones and friends. What we fail to realize is what Thoreau discovered, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. Life pays off most handsomely when we're doing that which we most want to do, when we're actually living the life we have imagined for so long. It does mean that we should live the life that we know deep down in our very being that we would most like to live. It means that we should be doing that which every indicator of our makeup, every fiber of our being tells us we should be doing and has been telling us for some time. When an idea tugs at us day after day, year after year, when we think about it as we lie awake in bed or the first thing when we wake up or every time there's a lull in our days, when it worries our consciousness like a puppy with a slipper, then it's time to do something about it. And even though making the move might seem to jeopardize everything of order in our lives, one of the ultimate tests of faith is our capacity to go on believing that somehow the right is the right, even when right is on the scaffold and wrong seems to be on the throne. All of the great ventures of our lives require faith enough to bear the burden of our doubts so that we're able to take the first step in the direction that we wish to go. Enough of faith to keep on going through struggle and strain and to maintain integrity on the way. Faith, as the ancient seer wrote, is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And we need to exchange a life of doubt diversified by faith for one of faith diversified by doubt. When a person doesn't know what harbor he's making for, no wind is the right wind. You have to know what you're shooting for to see the opportunity by which we're all surrounded.
If a man is working toward a predetermined goal and knows where he's going, that man is a success. If he's not doing that, he's a failure. The opposite of courage in our society is not cowardice, it is conformity. People acting like everyone else, without knowing why, without knowing where they're going. These people believe that their lives are shaped by circumstances, by things that happen to them, by exterior forces. The only man who succeeds is the man who is progressively realizing a worthy ideal. He's the man who says, I'm going to become this, and then begins to work toward that goal. And have you ever noticed that a man who becomes successful tends to continue to become successful? And on the other hand, have you noticed how a man who is a failure tends to continue to fail? It's because of goals. Some of us have them, some don't. People with goals succeed because they know where they're going. Now, it stands to reason that a person who's thinking about a concrete and worthwhile goal is going to reach it, because that's what he's thinking about. And we become what we think about. Conversely, the man who has no goal, who doesn't know where he's going, and whose thoughts must therefore be thoughts of confusion and anxiety and fear and worry, becomes what he thinks about. His life becomes one of frustration, fear, anxiety, and worry. And if he thinks about nothing, he becomes nothing. Now think of a ship leaving a harbor, and think of it with the complete voyage mapped out and planned. The captain and crew know exactly where it's going and how long it will take. It has a definite goal. 9,999 times out of 10,000, it will get to where it started out to get. Now let's take another ship, just like the first, only let's not put a crew on it, or a captain at the helm. Let's give it no aiming point, no goal, no destination. We just start the engines and let it go. I think you'll agree with me that if it gets out of the harbor at all, it will either sink or wind up on some deserted beach, a derelict. It can't go any place because it has no destination and no guidance. It's the same with a human being. Why do men with goals succeed in life and men without them fail? Well, let me tell you something which, if you really understand it, will alter your life immediately. If you understand completely what I'm going to tell you from this moment on, your life will never be the same again. You'll suddenly find that good luck just seems to be attracted to you. The things you want just seem to fall in line. And from now on, you won't have the problems, the worries, the gnawing lump of anxiety that perhaps you've experienced before. Doubt, fear, well, they'll be things of the past. Here's the key to success, and the key to failure. We become what we think about.
I think one of the sharpest distinctions between people is between the small percent who look words up in the dictionary and the overwhelming majority that don't. I find it especially helpful when I discover something about the origins of words in ancient or foreign languages. I looked up the word character in the dictionary. I learned the origin of the word, and then I just sat there for a minute and realized that in this case, the origin of the word just about says it all. So I'm going to tell you where the word character comes from, and I hope it has as big an effect on you as it did on me. Character comes from a Greek word meaning chisel, or the mark left by a chisel. I'm going to repeat that because I think it's very important. Character is derived from the Greek word for chisel. And of course, a chisel is a sharp steel tool used for making a sculpture out of a hard or difficult material like granite or marble. And a chisel is also used for stripping away waste material from an object, stripping away stuff that might get in the way in order to get down to the essential thing, the thing that really matters. And I hope you'll remember that. You've got to chisel your character out of the raw material of yourself, just like a sculptor has to create a statue. The raw material is always there. Everything that happens to you, good or bad, is an opportunity for building your character. Character doesn't refer to other people. It doesn't refer to having power over other people or getting other people to follow you, or gaining favor with other people. Character is something that you have and that you are. Character is all about you. Character is the person you are after you've chiseled and chiseled and have gotten past all the unnecessary material to what's underneath. Character is what's left after charisma is gone. The essential point is this. I don't think character is something that just happens by itself. A conscious process of design is at work. character is the result of hundreds and hundreds of choices you may make that gradually turn who you are at any given moment into who you want to be. If that decision-making process is not present, you'll still be somebody. You'll still be alive, but may have a personality rather than a character. Character isn't something you were born with and can't change like your fingerprints. It's something you weren't born with and that you must take responsibility for making. You may not be able to cross the Rocky Mountains in a covered wagon, but you can still create a better life for yourself by crossing the mountains of your soul. And that may be even a greater challenge. I don't think adversity by itself builds character, and I certainly don't think that success erodes it. You can build character by how you respond to what happens in your life, whether it's winning every game or losing every game, or getting rich or dealing with hard times. You build character out of certain qualities that you must create and diligently nurture within yourself, just like you would plant and water a seed, or gather wood and build a campfire. You've got to look for those things in your heart and in your gut. You've got to chisel away in order to find them, just like chiseling away rock in order to create the sculpture that has previously existed only in your imagination. But the really amazing thing about character is that if you're sincerely committed to making yourself into the person you want to be, you'll not only create those qualities, you'll strengthen them and recreate them in abundance even as you're drawing on them every day of your life. Character sustains itself and nurtures itself even as it's being put to work and tested and challenged. Since ancient times, philosophers have seen it as the basis of all real achievement. This is the quality of courage. I can't put it any better than the Greek philosopher Aristotle did more than 2,000 years ago. A truly courageous person is not someone who never feels fear, but who fears the right thing at the right time, in the right way. For a mature human being, there has got to be some higher value or higher truth than just staying on in life. Part of wisdom is knowing what you lack and looking for it. And asking for it. Another part of wisdom is knowing, at the same time as you ask, that there are no final answers. There are always more questions. Remember, you're never really helpless, and the sense that you are helpless or that you might be if certain things were to happen, is something we really ought to be afraid of, and that we should refuse to accept. You're never just a victim of circumstances. No matter what happens, you're never without options that can get you back on track. It takes courage to recognize that, because it means accepting responsibility for your own future. Let me emphasize that underlying most fear is the fear of helplessness, of being victimized or being blown around by the winds of fate like a leaf is blown off a tree. But is that really a legitimate way of looking at things? To me, it sounds like being afraid of the dark. In which case, the best thing to do is to get yourself up, out of bed, and switch on the light. It's only in the past 50 years or so people have come to expect a life without real tough times and real difficulties. But adversity isn't something to fear. It's something to expect, something to prepare for, and something to overcome. The truly courageous person is not immune to fear, but it plays a different role in his or her life than it does for other people. If you're a courageous person, your fears aren't about what someone might do to you or something that might happen to you. Your fears are about not living up to your ideals, about reacting instead of acting, about not taking advantage of the opportunities that are always within reach. A truly courageous person is not afraid of what might or might not happen next week or next year. He fears not making the most of every moment today. A truly courageous person fears the impulse to dominate other people. She leads by helping others to be their best. In ancient Greece, the philosopher Demosthenes went searching for an honest man, and he never found one. Honesty and integrity are rather rare, despite the fact that these are some of the clearest, most easily recognized elements of strong character. In the real world, they're also some of the most difficult to find. It seems it's always been that way. There was a time when telling a lie was very serious business. It was also very serious if you accused someone of lying. For hundreds of years in the past, calling someone a liar was the most common way to provoke a duel, at first with swords, later with pistols. Dishonesty was treated like a personal insult that demanded immediate redress. But there's no such risk today, is there? Some people lie all the time without thinking about it. Most people know when they're being lied to, which they may find irritating, but they just accept it. Maybe they decide to become liars themselves. It's a price they're willing to pay in order to have exactly what they want right now. There are many situations where it's painful to tell the truth. It's more like a boomerang that's going to come around and hit you in the back of the head someday. Let me give you some good advice about avoiding a bankrupt character. Pay your ethical debts. Keep your integrity in the black. Face ugly realities with the truth as soon as they appear. When you feel that temptation to hedge, resist it immediately. Don't treat it casually. Treat it like a grease fire in the kitchen that you've got to put out before it burns your house down or fills the whole place up with so much smoke that you can't see where you're going anymore. Because that's exactly what will happen when your ethical capital runs out. You just won't be able to see where you're going anymore. Any addictive behavior offers a simple, short-term escape from a problem. But that escape becomes more and more complicated as time goes on. Shakespeare had it right all along. What a tangled web we weave when at first we practice to deceive. Lying with an ulterior motive, lying for personal gain, that kind of lying is definitely something to be avoided. It's not the kind of behavior that defines strong character. Real lying is like theft. It's creating an illusion. Usually the people who are being deceived awaken from the illusions that have been foisted upon them. But even if this never happens, the criminal, and I don't think that's too strong a word, has to buy into the illusion so deeply himself that his own sense of reality is eroded. By trying to loosen other people's grasp of the truth, you end up losing your own. It all comes from fear. Somebody is afraid the truth about themselves isn't good enough, so they depart from the truth. It's really cowardice. Courage is fearing the right thing at the right time and in the right way. fear the temptation to misrepresent who you are or what you've done or intend to do. Trust who you really are. Trust your ability to earn the respect of others. Pay whatever price the truth costs. Pay that bill immediately. Because in the long run, it's a real bargain. Honesty and integrity are absolutely essential to survival. This is an extremely important element of strong character. Goals are major to a genuinely success-oriented person. Without them, you're just playing around. Despite everything that's been written about the importance of goal setting, very few people actually put it into practice. Challenge creates strong character, and goals represent challenge in its most positive form. What do I want to do? What do I want to be? What do I want to see? What do I want to have? Where do I want to go? Above all, persevere. Goal setting is a very important first step, but goal achievement is a continuous, lifelong process. That's what makes it so challenging. Perseverance is about as important to goal achievement as gasoline is to driving a car. Sure, there will be times when you feel like you're spinning your wheels, but you'll always get out of the rut with genuine perseverance. Without it, you won't even be able to start your engine. It's ironic, isn't it? Wisdom is not a thing you can buy, or a course you can take in school, or a degree you can earn. Wisdom is not really something you can get from another person, yet you can gain some wisdom from everyone you meet. Wisdom is something a wise man always feels he needs more of. Yet the true sources of wisdom lie nowhere but within ourselves. You're never just a victim of circumstances. It takes courage to recognize that, because it means accepting responsibility for your own future. If you're a courageous person, your fears aren't about what someone might do to you or something that might happen to you. Your fears are about not living up to your ideals, about reacting instead of acting, about not taking advantage of the opportunities that are always within reach. Class is calling on reserve energy. Class is the ability to overcome any number of challenges during a race. Class doesn't mean you never get tired, but it does mean you never show it. Class doesn't mean you're not tempted to quit sometimes, but it does mean you never actually do. And in the final yards of a race, class makes the difference. This is an extremely important element of strong character. I also suspect that in recent years we've overlooked the importance of perseverance to some extent, because we believe so strongly in talent as the true determinant of success. Perseverance means you never quit. Procrastination usually means you never get started. Although I consider the inability to finish something to be a form of procrastination. I'm a perfectionist. Everything has to be just right before I can get down to work. No distractions, not too much noise, no telephone calls interrupting me. And of course I have to be feeling well physically too. I can't work when I have a headache. The other end of procrastination, being unable to finish, also has a perfectionist explanation. I'm just never satisfied. I'm my own harshest critic. If all the I's aren't dotted and all the T's aren't crossed, I just can't consider that I'm done. That's just the way I am, and I'll probably never change. Do you see what's going on here? A fault is being turned into a virtue. The perfectionist is saying that his standards are just too high for this world. This fault into virtue syndrome is a common defense when people are called upon to discuss their weaknesses. But in the end, it's just a very pious kind of excuse making. The basis of procrastination could be fear of failure. That's what extreme perfectionism really is once you take a hard look at it. What's the difference whether you're afraid of being less than perfect or afraid of anything else? You're still paralyzed by fear. What's the difference whether you never start or never finish? You're still stuck. You're still going nowhere. You're still overwhelmed by whatever task is before you. You're still allowing yourself to be dominated by a negative vision of the future in which you see yourself being criticized or laughed at or punished or ridden out of town on a rail. Of course, this negative vision of the future is really a mechanism that allows you to do nothing. It's a very convenient mental tool. I'm going to show you how to turn procrastination into perseverance. I'm going to be very specific about how you can do this. A moment ago, I referred to a negative vision of the future as a mental tool for inactivity. If you've been using that tool, I'm going to ask you to toss it aside and start using two other very powerful principles that foster productivity and perseverance instead of passivity and procrastination. The first principle is, break it down. No matter what you're trying to accomplish, whether it's writing a book or climbing a mountain or painting a house, the key to achievement is your ability to break down the task into manageable pieces and knock them off one at a time. Focus on accomplishing what's right in front of you at this moment and ignore what's off in the distance someplace. Substitute real-time positive thinking for negative future visualization. That's the first all-important technique for bringing an end to procrastination. Suppose I were to ask you if you could write a 400-page novel. If you're like most people, that would be an impossible task. Yes, somebody must have written the book that you see in your mind's eye, but that person surely wasn't you. But suppose I ask you a different question. Suppose I ask if you can write a page and a quarter a day for 1 year. Do you think you could do it? Now the task is starting to seem more manageable. We're breaking down the 400-page book into bite-sized pieces. But even so, I suspect many people would still find the prospect intimidating. Do you see why? Writing a page and a quarter may not seem so bad, but you're being asked to look ahead one whole year. When people start to look that far ahead, many of them automatically go into a negative mode. So let me formulate the idea of writing a book in yet another way. Let me break it down even more. Suppose I were to ask you, can you fill up a page and a quarter with words, not for a year, not for a month, not even for a week, but just today? Don't look any further ahead than that. Do you think you can do it? One day at a time, you've probably heard that phrase. That's what we're doing here. We're breaking the time required for a major task down into one-day segments. Keep this up for 1 year, and you'll write the book. Discipline yourself to look neither forward nor backward, and you can accomplish things you never thought you could possibly do. Then all you have to do is persevere. Procrastination won't be a problem because the task is now so small that fear won't kick in. And it all begins with those three words, break it down. My second technique for defeating procrastination is also only three words long. The three words are, write it down. Instead of describing the things that you want to do or the places you want to go, you're going to describe what you actually do with your time, and you're going to keep a written record of the places you actually go. In other words, you're going to keep a diary of your activities, and you're going to be amazed by the distractions, detours, and downright wastes of time that you come up with during the course of a day. All of these get in the way of achieving your goals. For many people, it's almost like they planned it that way, and maybe at some unconscious level, they did. It forces you to see what you're actually doing and what you're not doing. And you should keep this up for at least a week. You don't have to do anything else at all. It's just a process for making yourself aware of how you actually spend your time. You will naturally and effortlessly begin to reorganize your life. Perhaps that seems like too much to believe, but it's true. When you're forced to write down the fact that you hung out at the coffee machine for 15 minutes today, you'll think twice about doing that again tomorrow. When you've got to put it in writing that you worked on an important project for 30 minutes today and then took a break to read the newspaper, you'll persevere a little longer on the project tomorrow and forget about the newspaper. Break it down, write it down. This is how you put an end to procrastination. This is how you get yourself started. But how do you keep going? How do you keep your motivation consistently high? How do you learn to persevere when the novelty is worn off and you're still some distance from your goal? The Irish poet William Butler Yeats once wrote a poem describing some of the unfortunate characteristics of the modern world. One of the things Yeats noticed was the fact that bad people seem to have the most energy, while good people become discouraged and doubtful of their own abilities. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with a passionate intensity. Those are the words Yeats used. And it's true that we can look around the world and see all sorts of things happening that we might wish were not happening. And there are people working very hard to make those things happen for reasons that we might not admire. And when we see that, it's easy to start saying, what's the use? What hope do I really have? Why don't I just give up on all the things I've been trying to accomplish and just start taking it easy. Even people of strong character feel that way sometimes. All of us have moments like that. That's when perseverance gets really, really tough. What's the answer? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to see? What do you want to have? Where do you want to go? With whom do you want to share? In other words, who are you working for besides yourself? Who is depending on you? Who will benefit if you persevere and succeed? Who will suffer if you give up and stop trying?
I'm scared. The world is full of bad things. That's why I have to become stronger.
Who can you reach out to and help once you've achieved your goals?
The world's not a dark place. That's a lie.
If you have a family, your spouse and your children are depending on you. Perhaps even your parents are depending on you now, if they're elderly and require some care. But even if you're a single person or just starting out in your career, you can think of reasons to persevere and succeed that go beyond your personal needs. This sharing doesn't have to be limited to money either. If your work has given you certain skills, you can share your time and your abilities. You can and you should. But even this isn't putting it strongly enough. It isn't just that you'll do better if you feel you're working for others in addition to yourself. You absolutely must find reasons outside yourself to persevere if you want to keep going when the going gets tough. Hemingway wrote, "A man alone hasn't got a chance." And that doesn't mean only that you need people to help you in life. It means also that you need people you can help. You need people who can become the real reasons for perseverance above and beyond your material possessions or your financial success. What's in it for me can only take you so far. What's in it for somebody besides me can take you as far as you need to go. In the last days of World War II, the American cruiser Indianapolis was sunk by an enemy submarine. This was one of the most tragic incidents of the war for American forces, in which hundreds of men lost their lives. Many who made it through the initial attack had to spend days and nights in the water before rescuers arrived. The experience of trying to stay alive in the water was so overwhelming that many people simply gave up. In fact, the survivors reported later that virtually everyone wanted to give up at one time or another. But whenever someone wanted to quit trying, the others would talk to him about the people back home who needed him, who were depending on him to survive. And if there was no one who was depending on him right then, they would talk about people in the future who would someday be needing him. People he hadn't met yet, people who hadn't even been born yet. This motivation beyond the self was the only motivation that was strong enough. Some of us are hungry for wealth and power. Some of us are hungry for truth. Some people want everyone to love them. Others want everyone to fear them. But there's a fundamental challenge with all these appetites. None of them can ever be permanently satisfied. When it comes to wanting things, there's never any such thing as enough. You get a new car, but in a couple of years, it's an old car. You get a new computer. It does everything real fast, certainly faster than the one your neighbor's got. But then a year goes by, and now your neighbor gets a computer that's even faster than yours. Where does it all end? There's really only one kind of person who's actually comfortable with the impossibility of satisfying his appetites. This is the person who wants that mysterious commodity called wisdom, whatever that is, and wants it more than all the cars and computers in the world. Wisdom, like the learning capacity of the human brain, is infinite. There will always be more to know, and there will always be plenty of room in your brain for everything you learn. Life is a paradise, really, if you're a person who genuinely wants wisdom. I hope you'll understand that it's in your best interests to take responsibility for everything you do. But that's only the beginning. I'm also going to suggest that many times it's even best to accept responsibility for the mistakes of others. I can hear you saying, "What? Accept responsibility for someone else's mess-ups? Why would I want to do something like that?" Just look at a baby during the first few years of life. Every gesture, every facial expression, every tentative word has one message for the baby's parents. The message is, "I am totally dependent on you. I can't do anything for myself, even if I try. I can't be held responsible for the consequences. After all, I'm just a baby." 10 or 12 years later, of course, as the boy or girl enters adolescence, this message to the parents will be very different. It will sound something like this: "Why don't you just leave me alone? I want to be totally independent. I don't want to do anything but think about myself. I certainly don't want to accept any responsibility for anything beyond my own very well-defined needs and desires." It's only when we're at last grown up that the first two messages, "I'm totally dependent on you" and "I'm totally independent of you," finally turn into "You can depend on me." Which is the truly adult outlook. Strange as it may seem, of course, there are people in their 30s and 40s who are still acting like adolescents. And there are even people in their 40s and 50s who are still acting like babies as far as their attitude toward responsibility is concerned. These kinds of people can be hard to have around, especially if you have to work with them. Let me be more specific about exactly what is involved in becoming a responsible person. It means, first of all, that you accept the consequences of your actions. But I'll go even further than that. Responsibility means you look to yourself as the source of everything that happens to you. It means that you assume command, regardless of the hardships you may have undergone early in life, or the prejudice you may have encountered, or the dozens of people who may have failed to understand you. Do I sound hard-hearted? Do I seem to be denying the existence of difficult childhoods or of prejudice or of people who are insensitive to the needs of others? Well, that is certainly not my intention, nor is it my belief. I'm saying that regardless of the presence of those negative influences in your life, the best thing you can do, the most empowering thing, the strongest thing, and ultimately the wisest thing, is to accept responsibility for your own destiny, plain and simple. The benefits of this approach to life have been proven in some pretty dramatic ways. People who have been afflicted by serious illness, for example, appear to have a better chance of recovery if they decide to take responsibility for what has happened to them, despite the fact that it would be easier and perhaps even more reasonable to simply see themselves as victims of fate. I've gotten myself locked into a certain kind of thinking, and now I've got to get myself out of it. It's as simple as that. Anybody can have an excuse for absolutely anything, and people have never been better at it than they are today. But the downside of excuses, even good ones, is that nobody really believes them. I don't care what people tell you, if you make excuses, they're going to know it, and they're going to think less of you. But if you refuse to rely on excuses, people are going to know that too, and they'll admire you for it. So many people use excuses, but nobody really buys them. It's our modern version of the fable about the boy who cried wolf. An offshoot of the I didn't mean to do it excuse for evading responsibility is the I wasn't myself at the time excuse. It's like being at the helm of a ship. You are responsible for everything that takes place on your watch. You must wake up from the dream that somebody else will handle the pressure, that somebody else will shoot those two free throws. I slept and dreamed that life was beauty. I woke and saw that life was duty. A strong character is not a rigid character. In fact, exactly the opposite is true. Although it's important to be firm when you know something is right and to maintain that right position even when the crowd is going against you and wants to put you down. Sometimes when the tide has run against you for a long time, it may be that what you held as a certainty was in fact not true in the light of overwhelming circumstances. It's not only right, it's also smart to be able to see more than one way to accomplish a task. It's wise to see more than one solution to any problem. It's a good skill to see things as someone else might see them. Because when the plan that served you so well for so long doesn't work anymore, then it's time to find another way. It's time to bend. It's time to move on, to change, to compromise, to talk. Or you'll risk snapping like a dead branch in a stiff breeze. I don't really think it's less important or more important today to be open to change and flexible in adapting to it than it has been in the past. It's always been important to be flexible and far-sighted, anticipating whenever we can, and when we can't anticipate, being prepared for all possibilities. Sometimes it is best to advance by retreating. Sometimes wars can be won by losing a few battles. And long-term goals can be achieved by accepting short-term reversals. Sometimes it is best to resist like the tall grasses bending in the wind, or like a river finding a new route around an obstacle. A powerful ocean wave smashing onto a beach may wash away a sand dune, but the individual grain of sand simply goes with the flow and is unharmed. Flexibility is simple in theory, but tremendously challenging in practice. It means we have to learn to distinguish between what we can control and what is beyond our control. Practicing flexibility requires great self-knowledge and iron self-control. To be flexible does not mean to be weak, to flounder about aimlessly and confused because we think there's nothing to be done. No, it requires self-discipline.